good, isn't it? I'm Nancy Nangeroni.
I'm Gordine McKenzie.
And this is Gender Talk. Hello again, this is Gender Talk Worldwide Radio that talks about transgenderism in the first person. Each week we bring you news, information, and exciting new voices that challenge our traditional view of gender and more. Tonight we'll be visiting first with feminist lesbian performance poet and winner of the 1999 Outright Poetry Slam, Alex Olson. We'll ask Alex, along with friend and performance partner Neve, to perform some of their poetry for us. Then we'll meet the author of one of the best-selling science fiction novels of all time, Samuel Delaney. The book is called Dahlgren, and we'll talk with the author about racial, sexual, and gender themes in his work and in the world of science fiction. And because we're the realization of yesterday's science fiction, we'll also have the Twisted Nasty News Question of the Week and much more tonight on Gender Talk. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another hour and a half of Gender Talk. I'm your co-host, Nancy Nangeroni.
I'm Gordine McKenzie.
Yes. And we're here to just chow through a whole bunch of great stuff tonight. We're very psyched. We had the... let me introduce everybody before I launch into everything. On the board in Cambridge, sitting behind all those knobs and dials, is our very own...
Hal Fuller.
Hey, Hal.
Hey.
How are you doing tonight?
Woo-hoo.
That must be Karen Larson.
It must be.
Yep.
Hey, Karen, how you guys doing tonight?
I'm okay. I'm trying to clear the chocolate cupcake from my mouth.
You're making me hungry, Karen.
And, of course, let me introduce here on the board tonight, for the first time doing solo, well, not doing solo because she's got Joe Warnes there with her, but on the board here at KUNM in Albuquerque, Katrina Lucas.
Hey, Sam's Katrina. Chocolate Cupcake.
Sam's Chocolate Cupcake. All right. How are you guys doing tonight?
Wait a minute. What about chocolate cupcake?
She said sans, as in without chocolate cupcake.
Oh, okay.
That's right. And right. Joe Warnes.
That's French.
That's French. Can you give us any finish for that? Joe?
Without cupcake?
Yeah, can you do that?
No, I can't say without cupcake. All I can say is to all the Finnish people out there in Boston, meet that gulu.
Oh.
Meet that gulu?
What's that?
What's happening?
Oh, that reminded me of yoga that we were at yesterday.
How many more weeks do we have you, Joe, before you go? No, you're going to be around for a little while longer.
Yeah, I'll be here till almost August.
All right, and then you're
going to
go.
Where are you going?
Finland.
Joe is mad.
Helsinki.
Joe married a Finnish woman.
Yeah.
Can you say Helsinki on the air?
That we can say.
So Gordine and I are feeling all psyched because we went for this bike ride this morning. Really long bike
Doing
ride.
Doing it every morning. It's exciting.
Yeah. It's
just a new meditation.
Last week or so, since we had Marie and Sally visiting with us, our friends from back east, we've been bicycling almost every day. We did yoga yesterday.
Yeah,
we went to
yoga,
our first ever yoga class. What fun that was.
I like the warrior pose.
My body hasn't felt that good in a while.
I loved
really
it.
Really limbered me up, stretched me out and everything.
Me too.
But we went for a great bike ride this morning. We saw some cool things. What did we see?
We saw baby quail following their mother right across the bike path with another quail following behind.
If you've ever seen quail run, imagine a whole bunch of teens.
Six of them.
Tried, but they didn't nominate him.
They're like small.
Oh, Hal.
Well, it was pretty cool.
I had to.
That's all right.
Can you spell potato?
The wild ones.
They were teensy little things. It was wonderful to see them following their mom. But we also saw a very distressing sight on our ride. We saw not one but two mourning doves dead on the bike path. Now, this is something we've never seen before. And what was it you smelled last night? Maybe?
I don't know. We came home and we were trying to plant native moonflowers by the moonlight.
Yeah. What's the real name? They're like
Jimson weed.
Jimson weed.
Yeah, they're beautiful big white flowers that open up at night by moonlight.
They're wonderful.
And Nancy and I were digging around in our yard real late at night. And I smelled something really horrible, and I thought, is it propane, like from the gas grill or something? And I went sniffing around the neighborhood, and I figured there's some kind of poison out there, and then seeing those two dead birds.
Yeah, with no apparent cause of death. It was really unusual, because all the time we've been riding, we haven't seen any dead birds.
Who's spraying what where?
And then, And then we're sitting, then we decide to treat ourselves to a breakfast at this place around the corner from us that we've been, you know, wanting to try out. So we're sitting there at breakfast, and they've got the radio show, radio playing, and it was it KQEO or something?
KQEO.
And they have this ad on the radio that says, and this is a direct quote, "Baldness is as bad as losing your manhood." And they went on to make all this, to like totally heighten every poor man's insecurity about hair on their head being somehow related to their
losing
sexuality.
Their virility, and they even mentioned virility.
Patrick Stewart.
Yes, that's the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah, and what was the other one that played, Shall We Dance?
I don't know.
Yul Brynner.
Yul Brynner.
Yeah. Oh, this, I mean, it's ridiculous. I think that we need to vote with our ears for against this kind of insidious onslaught onto our sort of unconscious and to our self-confidence. We need to vote with our ears and consciously tune out stations that broadcast that kind of, excuse me, junk.
They're inscribing insecurity on the male body just as bad as they have on the female body forever and ever.
It's ridiculous. There's no reason why we have to put up with that kind of advertising. All it takes is a couple of letters to people advertising, running those kinds of ads. It's despicable to heighten people's insecurities just so you can sell your product. There's no excuse for that.
And while we're at it, do it against the women's ads, too, to have bigger zooms, et cetera.
You know, that's one place where we can all be really very effective. Sometimes it only takes one well-written letter to change an advertising policy. Hey, Sky Publishing, remember we've been talking about how Sky Publishing, Karen, you and Hal have been following this with us, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Sky Publishing is challenging the Cambridge Human Rights Ordinance, the constitutionality of that ordinance, and we spoke with them, and they said, well, we're doing this because we didn't get a fair shake from the Cambridge Human Rights Commission. I spoke with people on the Human Rights Commission. I spoke with a commissioner, and I also spoke with someone who worked daily at the commission and who was in part responsible for that finding. And what I was told was, basically, that it is their standard policy to always contact both sides in any dispute. And although the person I was speaking to wouldn't talk about the specifics of the case, the obvious inference was that either they had contacted people on both sides or they were acknowledging that if they hadn't, a mistake had been made. So at the same time, though, a legal eagle friend of ours tells us that Sky Publishing's assertion that the only course of action they have is to challenge the constitutionality of the ordinance does not hold water, and that is not sufficient justification by Sky Publishing for challenging the constitutionality of that ordinance. Now, I also find out something else, which is that when there is a discrimination complaint which is covered by state law, it automatically bumps up to the state agency, the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, MCAD. And so MCAD will handle all complaints except those that are only covered by the local ordinance. In this case, this was a complaint, again, on the basis of gender and sex. So the sex complaint bumped up to Massachusetts, but the gender complaint, because it isn't that isn't written into Massachusetts law, only went to the Cambridge Commission. Now, the why that is interesting is because the Massachusetts ordinance or law has a procedure written into the law for people who feel they haven't gotten a fair shake. It has an appeals procedure, but the Cambridge ordinance does not have an appeals procedure. And the person that I spoke with in the Sonia was her name, in the Cambridge office, said that there was actually that some consideration was being given to whether or not the Cambridge law should be amended to include an appeals procedure, but that was not related to the Sky Publishing situation. So we have a situation where, you know, things aren't quite adding up, and our legal friend advises us to keep the pressure on Sky Publishing, to keep letting them know that even if they feel they haven't gotten totally fair treatment from the Cambridge Human Rights Commission, that's no excuse for launching a constitutional attack on the ordinance. And the case law is mixed in terms of how this might go. And so We definitely need to keep the pressure on. Keep sending letters to Sky Publishing. If you haven't sent one, go to the Gender Talk website, gendertalk.com, and there's all the information you need to know there to write an email or to send a letter to Sky Publishing and let them know that even if that probable cause finding was not, even if they feel that that's unfair, that attacking the constitutionality of the ordinance is not a reasonable response. It's not the best channel for them to go with their complaint about that treatment that they got. Anyway, that's our update on Sky Publishing. And now I'm out of breath.
Well, I got a couple of things while you breathe.
Yeah.
One, I think this is our sixth anniversary or thereabouts.
Within a week or so of it.
It started in early June.
That's right. Oh, my gosh. I think it would be next week. I think we started on June 14th, 1965.
There you go. No wonder I feel old. 1995.
We started on June 14th.
June 14th.
Yeah, I believe that was our first show. Or was it the 7th, Hal? Do you remember?
It was just before Pride.
Was it just before Pride?
I think so.
But are you guys on the news? Are we on the new season there at WMBR yet? Or is that next week? We don't even know.
I don't know.
We got our slot. I stopped paying attention.
Okay. Well, anyway, that's a great thing to bring up, Hal. Our sixth anniversary. That's pretty cool.
If not this week, then next week, but, you know, around that time.
Well, this is show number 313, divide by 52, and so this probably is the first show of
the sixth year. I need Ross to do that for me, and he's not here right now.
All right, did you have something else?
I did get an email from Ross today.
Yeah, I went to see the opening of Two Tall Blondes in Love, which is playing at the Boston Center for the Arts Black Box Theater.
Kate Bornstein and Barbara Correas, who we had on the show last week.
I wish I could have been there.
It was great.
Was it good?
Yeah, it was very good. I've never seen Kate perform, so it was a special treat for me.
Is she?
You walk in, and like the theater is done in early U-Haul. It's boxes all over the place.
Sounds like how our house is going to be. Boxes make up a table.
And then Kate and Barbara come on and give you their life and how they got together. It was wonderful, amazing.
Yeah, I haven't seen Barbara perform yet, but I know that Kate is the most amazingly engaging, energetic performer, and she puts her all into it and transforms.
She's electric.
She transforms her audience and herself by the energy of her performance. Just amazing. Wonderful stuff. Glad to hear about it, Hal.
Yeah, I had seats right in the front row, so at times they were like a foot away from me.
How wonderful.
I'm rubbing it in, aren't I?
Yeah, you certainly are.
We even thought about flying back.
You just wait. We're going to do something wonderful here in Albuquerque and then tell you all about it.
We are doing wonderful things.
You have.
Yeah. I guess we have.
We sat in the Bowls of the Earth in the El Malpai recently and went to the Enchanted Mesa.
Very magic. Some amazing places out here. Yeah.
Just basically, Two Tall Blondes in Love is going to be running through June the 16th.
Yeah.
And go see them.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Brilliant.
We need to move along. Anything else, guys?
That's about it.
Okay. Let's get to our question of the week because we have two really fantastic guests tonight. One of them is pre-recorded. That interview with Alex Olson and with her performance partner Neve. And then after that, we'll be talking live with Samuel Delaney, who is just a fascinating man. This is going to be great stuff. So let's get to our question of the week. Here's our question for show 313, June 4th. Why has the transgender movement taken the word gender as a social issue when half of gender is the physical aspect, the body? Because of endocrine health problems, many people are straight gender socially, but are variant gender physically. I do not think your show has really addressed this. My connection with this is a severe lifelong case of gynecomastia with no fatty material. Also, there are quite a number of men with my condition who are gay, bi, or cross-dressers. So gynecomastia, of course, is when a man develops breasts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Karen?
That's my first thing I was going to say. Okay, let's put a definition to gynecomastia.
Right. That's when somebody who is clearly a man or male develops breasts. We've all probably seen guys like this at one time. I know kids who had boys who develop this at all get terrible ribbing from their friends and or so-called friends get from other kids at school. I know that can be a source of a lot of anxiety.
Smoking marijuana can bring those breasts perking right
out. Is that right?
According to some analysts.
If that's really true, then that's really going to alter my behavior, Mackenzie.
Well, gee. Which way, honey?
I don't know. This is an interesting one. A severe lifelong case of gynecomastia and gender, physical gender versus sort of, in other words, sort of body gender and how your body is versus how your beliefs are or how you feel about yourself and so forth.
Well, for one thing, we have done quite a bit of coverage on intersexuality, which has a physical aspect to it. Certainly, it's mostly physical.
In fact, yeah, I would say that probably falls into the same category of people who whose bodies put out kind of mixed gender signals at one time or another, and I guess that would be what gynecomastia is. I would think that, it's hard to know what to say about something like this. Maybe we can do a program on it at some point. Certainly, there are plenty of guys out there who have gynecomastia. Some of them, I guess, get medical treatment, but I'm sorry, we don't actually have any.
I know several cross-dressers that have that condition, but they're not complaining.
Yeah.
I guess, you know what, let's go to our next question. We're going to come back to this question another time. I shouldn't have gone to it because I need to do some research on gynecomastia. And this question was from William. Thank you, William. We'll do some more work on that one.
Well, maybe just even summing up and saying that we are talking about the body changing without a conscious choice there when we're talking about things here.
Okay.
And well, then you need to think about that.
Okay. Then we'll take another question quick. Here's one from Stacy Garrison. It says, my face looks just as soft and passive as it possibly could some days and hard and aggressive other days. Does testosterone play a role in this? And if so, how?
Well, it might and it might not.
That about covers it.
Yeah, portrait of Dorian Gray.
certainly testosterone. It's interesting because it's not clear that testosterone is so much the cause as the effect of changing emotional conditions in your life.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, Stacy's face is probably reflecting mood, and testosterone may have something to do with mood. But
yes, exactly. But testosterone is also produced in connection with things that are going on in your life.
Absolutely.
And I know that when I have something particularly good going on. In my life, after I transitioned, the first job I ever got, as the Nancy, was also the highest paying job I had ever had up to that point. And I was so thrilled and excited, I was horny as can be for about a week. About a month. I know my testosterone levels were elevated, and that was part of that. Cause that's kind of how that stuff works, right? And so, I would say that it's probably more the things that are going on in your life than fluctuations of testosterone that are causing changes to your facial expression. And you may be also experiencing changes in testosterone level in response to the things that are going on in your life. But I think my opinion on this, and it's just an opinion, is that I doubt that the testosterone is what's causing it. Now, people who take testosterone, for example, female-to-male transsexuals, their faces will change in response to the testosterone. But that's a very different kind of situation. That's not a situation where you just, where you're not, I mean, that's a situation where you're injecting yourself with testosterone. In terms of day-to-day,
if you're female,
what
and you're having those hormonal kind of things going on, your skin changes. I mean, it can break out.
That's right.
Get puffy, all that kind of crap.
Yeah. So in that case, then, but it's not clear that it's testosterone so much as
female hormones.
That's right. Good old estrogen and progesterone and so forth.
Some people say estrogen makes you look softer, and testosterone makes you look a little more jagged edge.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. I think that's
combos of them all.
Yeah.
It's whatever we call to the fore.
Stacy, thanks for your question. I think the consensus here is that probably what's going on in your life and how you feel about those things plays a bigger role than the testosterone in terms of how your face looks. Send your question to question@gendertalk.com. And while you're doing that, while you're writing up your question to send it to us, we're going to go to Hell 4.
And the Gender Talk, Twisted, Nasty News. And we're going to start off with a story from Japan. A group of transgender Japanese citizens are asking their country to recognize their gender and names changes, according to Reuters News. Writer Masi Torai went to court on behalf of a group of six people on May the 24th to request the right to change their names on the official family registers, or koseke, kept by town halls. Quote, "I don't want a drastic change in any law. I just want to see the reference to my sex changed in the register," he told Reuters News. Sex change operations for people identified with gender identity disorder have been legal in Japan since 1998. We reported on that here. But conservative registrars at local government offices largely have refused to record name and gender changes in the koseki, citing laws that they say are only supposed to correct mistakes in the original entries.
Cool.
Interesting.
Yep. Moving in the right direction there. We'll see what happens.
And from the United States, as most of the stories are, millions of gay teenagers may be subjected to such widespread bullying and teacher indifference in U.S. schools that they do not receive an adequate education, according to the Human Rights Watch, a nonprofit advocacy and research organization. The study found school officials often refuse to accept reports of harassment of gays or hold the perpetrators accountable. In some cases, they have encouraged or participated in the abuse. Mm-hmm. Quote, "The U.S. school system gets a failing grade when it comes to providing a safe place for gay students to get an education," says Michael Boschenek, counsel to the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch and an author of the report. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender kids face a greater risk of bullying than any other students in American high schools. We knew that.
Well, unfortunately, the teachers don't seem to turn their heads away with all sorts of things, because not only gay students, if you're too heavy or too meek or whatever it is, you get pounced on by the other students.
Yeah, I'm a little...
Even if you're like a sissy-looking type boy, you could be straight, but you're tinier maybe, or you're perceived as effeminate. You get it, and it seems like the teachers just kind of turn their head and ignore all of it.
I think that's a great comment, Karen.
Not all teachers, though.
Certainly not. But I think that... I'm always hesitate. I always hate to hear that, you know, this is the most oppressed group or whatever. You know, these people get it worse than anybody else. Because in some places, it's people who are overweight or people who are too skinny or people who are Asian or people of color who get it the worst. So it depends on where you are. It depends on your context, whether or not you're the one who's getting it the worst. But certainly, the more we can eliminate this kind of ridiculous behavior and the more we can encourage our school teachers and administration to be responsive to complaints and to be vigilant against this sort of thing, that this should be part of the education kids receive at schools, to not haze one another because of differences like this.
I think there is a level of difference here. Most fat kids, and I was a fat kid and a bit femme in high school, I suppose, but I didn't get beat up because I was overweight. I damn near got beat up because they thought I was gay.
Oh, I know kids
there
who got...
There is a difference here.
Well, I know kids who got beat up because they were overweight, Hal.
It didn't happen to me. Maybe I ran faster than people thought I could.
Yeah.
But this is, this isn't to put down that there is a tremendous amount of violence committed about LGBT.
Yeah, I didn't mean to in any way say that there isn't tremendous violence on...
Let's move on to a clear case of discrimination.
Yeah.
An Air Force captain, and this is also in the, you really didn't say this category, an Air Force captain discharged after he told his superior officer that he was gay will have to repay the United States Air Force more than $70,000 for his medical education, according to a court ruling.
That's
crazy.
Wait
a minute. He was discharged by them?
Well, he told his superior officer that he was gay.
Uh-oh, he violated Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
He violated Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So he was discharged.
Now they want a refund.
And now the Air Force wants the money back.
Shit.
U.S. District Court Judge William Alsup's May 29th ruling said that Dr. John Hinsala, a psychiatrist, presumably understood that violating the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy would mean his discharge and thus prevent him from fulfilling his obligation of 4 years active service. It is not unreasonable to infer that one intends the probable and foreseeable consequences of deliberate conduct, said Alsup in his decision.
Oh, in other words, they're saying, oh, he wanted out, and that's why he told, essentially.
It's that he knew what he was doing, he knew what the consequences of his actions would be, and that now he has to pay those consequences.
Be interesting to hear more about the case and whether he was doing it to challenge the law, to call attention to it, or because he wanted out, or whether he just didn't know or wasn't thinking. Be interesting.
Yeah. And Sala learned in December 1994, maybe this will help, that his service commitment would begin at Scott Air Force Base in Illinois. With his lawyer's advice, he wrote his superior saying that he thought they knew he was gay and that it would not affect his ability to serve as a child psychiatrist. The USAF began an investigation, found strong evidence that Constantine Sala made the homosexual statement, hoping to trigger separation and avoid his active duty commitment.
Wait a minute. They were making him a child psychiatrist, and he was saying, and he wrote a letter to them saying, you know, I assume you know that I'm gay and that this won't cause a problem.
He thought they should know. I'm sorry, I misread it.
He thought they should know that he was
gay?
That he
was gay, and it wouldn't affect his ability to serve as a child psychiatrist.
You know, that's such a double bind. That's like when I was interviewing for jobs, and I thought, well, they probably should know that I'm transsexual in case they look back in the past or go to my references or whatever, who might have known me as John.
Yeah.
And so I thought I was doing the right thing. And it's interesting that this person is getting punished for doing what they thought was the moral thing in that situation. What a shame.
Yeah, it's just like trannies being told, don't tell anything about your past at all.
Yeah.
And we saw what harm that did.
Well, no, this is stealth with teeth.
Yeah, exactly. It's a sick policy.
Okay, moving along. A new German show on television called Big Diet, about obese people trying to slim down at a luxury health spa. One of the reality shows where the one who loses the most poundage wins his or her weight in gold coins was a rating disaster.
Good.
Yay!
Good. Yay, good.
The show ran on private TV station RTL2, which also had a flop with Camp for Maidens, another reality show, which recorded the seductive exploits of a single male dropped onto a desert island occupied only by nubile young females.
Boo.
Are we that desperate for programming?
Please.
Please.
People are desperate to get rich quick, Hal. And that's why we see so much, crap.
And exploit anything.
Yeah. Anyway.
Also in the stupidity department, in March, the principal of Stony Brook School in Brandenburg, New Jersey, ordered a 12-year-old hearing-impaired girl to stop using sign language on the school bus because it was somehow causing a disturbance.
Oh, boy.
That's another brilliant one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But here's some good news.
Yeah.
Women in villages and small towns across Slovakia continued this year to endure the 100 years tradition of Easter Monday, though not with the pain and humiliation suffered as recently as the 1950s. Historically, unmarried men ritually threw cold water on the women, then whipped the single women, and the women in turn rewarded the men with hard-boiled eggs and chocolate, and bragged about the number of men who had visited them. Nowadays, except in the remotest village, men gently spray scented water on them. I guess that's an improvement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big improvement.
And from
it's a strange, custom.
Changing roles. Speaking of roles, 5 2001 Rolls-Royce lines, Rolls-Royce being the ultimate
automobile
luxury car, or one of them, including the three most expensive models in the world, led by the $353,000 Corniche, had to be recalled to the factory when the power window switch ignited the car's fuel lines at a Michigan dealership and blew out the windows.
Oh, that's one way of opening the windows.
I mean, you know, when you hear about Ford doing a recall, but Rolls-Royce?
Yeah.
That's sad.
Yeah. Who cares?
Okay, in case you're wondering what you're listening to, this is Gender Talk on WNBR in Cambridge.
Yeah.
And here's a mixed to cloudy story. It may be hard to believe, but the singer who once provoked shockwaves with his X-rated lyrics, Prince, has sworn off cursing and is preaching about the importance of virtue in the May edition of Gotham Magazine. Prince, who is now a Jehovah's Witness, wrap your mind around that one, said that, quote, when you use those curse words, you go off all the anger, all the negative times the word has been used before. You bring it toward yourself. Why would you want that? Actually, I agree with him on that thought.
Yeah. I think you need to have good curse words. I'm sorry.
And a good curse and stick while you're at it.
Yeah. I mean, you need to be able to put some feeling into what you're saying. And sometimes that feeling is expressing anger or frustration. And you need a word for it. And, you know, maybe it doesn't need to be a curse word, but you need a word for it.
It's It's such a strange reversal, though, for someone who
basically
was selling sex and doing it very well.
What's sex got to do with cursing, though?
But his lyrics also were tending toward...
Yeah, but he's not swearing off sexuality. He's just swearing off cursing, right?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen any of his acts recently, so...
All right.
His videos were incredibly hot.
Yeah, he did great videos.
Our friend Marie used to write about him, published several articles on it.
We need to get to our first guest.
Okay, well, why don't we, because I lost the close story, so I guess Prince will be the last story that is this Gender Talk Twisty Nasty News, take only as directed.
Oh, thank you, Hal. I didn't mean to, like, boot you out of there.
This is WNBR in Cambridge. I think I said that.
Yeah, I think you did. And by the way, the views and opinions presented on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WNBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT. Gender Talk is a joint production of KUNM Albuquerque and WNBR Cambridge. And now I think we have our first guest. Let's roll it, Joe.
Okay, I'm happy to introduce Alex Olson, who is a spoken word artist and a folk poet. Alex also teaches at the LGBT high school, Hetrick Martin, and has been a award-winning slam poet. And we will also be we'll also be joined by Alex's partner, Neve, who is a co-producer of Feed the Fire Productions. And she runs the grant program, that has LGBT, youth going into the high schools. And is it into the high schools? Let me ask you. You're explaining a little bit to me.
Sure. We send spoken word artists into the LGBT high school in their after-school program.
Oh, great.
To teach spoken word, and also into the two high schools on the prison system in New York, which is Rikers Island, male and female high school.
And it's called Feed the Fire, Youth Aloud.
Yep.
Also, Neve is a drag king who does drag king workshops, and she goes by the name of Pat Reark.
Yes.
And so welcome to you both, and thank you for joining us at Gender Talk.
Thank you so much. We're so glad to be here.
Great.
It's a pleasure to have you here, guys. So tell us more about this program that you're doing, this spoken word program.
Well, I want you to talk about that, the spoken word program, sending the kids into the school.
Yeah, because that sounds very fascinating.
Hello.
Hi, Neve. How are you
doing? Hi, I'm doing all right. How about you?
Good. Welcome to Gender Talk.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us more about the spoken word program you're doing in the schools.
Well, so we were fortunate enough to get a grant from Grinnell College, which is my alma mater in Iowa. And they give alumni grants for social service projects. And so we received $25,000 to start doing some educational programming, which is, you know, really exciting. And
congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. And I think slam poetry and spoken word is just, you know, an amazingly motivating instrument to work with youth, you know, particularly youth who may have feel disenfranchised from, you know, traditional schooling in some way or something along those lines. You know, it's really empowers them and gets them really involved. So it's been, you know, an amazing experience. And we've got some chat books that we're going to be putting together for the end of the year. So if anybody is interested in you know, checking those out, you can request
some
them.
Some chat books?
Yeah,
chat
books is it's actually termed chapter book. It's kind of a abbreviation of that. And it's just, you know, sort of what poets do in terms of getting their poetry out there. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So
shows
you're
how much I know about poetry.
you're helping them find their voices, in
Absolutely.
Other words. Oh, great. And that can
cool.
be such an empowering experience, particularly as you move from oppression into speech and all that wonderful awareness of what we can do with it, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, right. it's really been phenomenal to see. Yeah. And we're hoping to continue it. There are a number of organizations that are developing curriculum for youth and slam poetry, and we're going to be partnering with them and, you know, keeping it going as much as we can, you know.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thanks so much, Neve.
Oh, no problem.
We appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, and Alex, recently you headlined, I understand, the Gender Pack Conference.
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
It was great. It was our first national conference, and it was held in D.C., and it was a real effort on their part to sort of bring together people who are dealing with gender issues in every way, across the board, not simply trans issues, although that's,
right.
as we know, not simple. But and so they brought in Patricia Ireland to speak about now and what the National Organization for Women is doing, and they brought me in, which I thought was really wonderful. So they really encompassed sort of so many gender issues, and the workshops reflected that, and we all had these great discussions about how to work for breaking down gender binaries and how that would benefit all of us. And it was, I mean, then I got to perform as well, so it's a great weekend.
Tell us about yourself and your work and what led you into the kind of work that led to your being invited to perform there.
Well, I performed at the National Organization for Women's National Conference about, maybe 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and have sort of been, I mean, gender is my primary passion, and I do it through spoken word and through highlighting, you know, issues through what I do.
Why is gender your passion?
I think it's, I'm passionate about sort of anything that restricts people. I think that's the main problem in our country, especially, although it's a global issue, is restriction. And I think gender is one of the main straitjackets in our society.
Do you personally feel that you've been restricted by it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I feel very free in what I do right now in my work, in my art. But I think that, you know, even if you look at what I'm paid versus what other, you know, male spoken word artists are being paid that I'm allies and friends with. And being a lesbian, obviously.
Really? So you're saying there's a pay differential even within the spoken word community?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And not only that, but I think, you know, if you look at the audience of who goes to a lesbian feminist spoken word artist as opposed to who goes to, you know, a straight male spoken word artist, I'd be much more likely, and I think you'd find a lot more women in that audience of the male as opposed to in my audience, which is pretty much, I would imagine, mostly women.
Yeah.
Well, I know it's mostly women. Which I mean, I don't mind. I love women, and that's who I have in my audience.
Given that you're a lesbian performance artist, I hope you love women.
Yeah. But I think
they're pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah.
The
but,
issue is that we'll go listen to the guys, but will they come and listen to lesbian feminists?
Oh, okay.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly. And they sort of accused, there's a lot of accusations made that lesbian feminists are not focusing on other issues. And I guess my feeling is, we're focusing on one particular issue in a lot of cases that the rest of the world is not focusing on. And so we have to stand up for ourselves. And then that's called being exclusive or restrictive.
Yeah.
I mean, in my work, I hope that I challenge other binaries and other issues as well. I think I try the best I can to bring sort of all the isms together in some ways. But
there's always criticism. Anytime any group of people try to lift themselves up out of various oppressions, and they do so, the only strategy we know of for doing that is affiliating with like-minded people and focusing on the issues that are oppressing you. And if that's being criticized as being too single-minded, then that criticism is just part of that system of oppression.
Exactly.
That says we don't want to hear you, basically, that there is one voice, and that dominant voice overrides it all.
We're having fun, and don't spoil our fun by telling us about how our fun is trampling on your garden.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
And I understand now that you're going to be one of the speakers and performers at an upcoming Dykes, Bitches, and Goddesses Celebrate Women's Pride.
Is that what it's called?
Yes.
I guess so.
Okay.
I'll be performing with Bitchin' Animal, who are a folk singing duo.
We have seen them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they're great.
So they'll be there.
I've had them on the show.
Yeah.
Some years ago.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, they're wonderful. And Antigone Rising, who they're a Dyke band, sort of rock and roll band, who I just performed with, and they're really fabulous too. And so the three of us groups are doing as a benefit for now.
Oh, that's great. And this is going to be June 8th?
Yep. And it'll be right after the Dyke March.
Oh, that's going to be exciting. At 8 p.m.,
yeah.
Show
uh-huh.
starts at 9 p.m., and it'll be, I understand, at the Paradise 969 Commonwealth Avenue
Absolutely.
In Boston.
Yep.
And right before this, you're releasing, is it going to be your first CD?
I am. It's my first CD. It's called Built Like That.
I love the title.
Built Like That?
Yeah.
Yeah, it features, it has two artists actually from the Boston area, Katie Curtis and Pamela Means are two of my backup musicians, and they just did such a wonderful job on it, so they're on a few of the tracks.
And it's really, it's sort of a spoken word music experience. And
wonderful.
I just kind of begged all my favorite musicians to play with me and work with me on it. And it, I think it turned out really, really well.
Oh, that's terrific. I wish we had a cut to play here.
Oh, I do too. Yeah. We'll be getting
we'll get one.
Do that. Yeah. What does Built Like That come from?
Yeah.
Built Like That is it's one of the tracks on the CD. And it's sort of about, it's challenging the idea of what art, is supposed to be. And, in a lot of ways, talking about what my art is not, and then, talking about what it is instead, and how what it's like to get to a place where I guess you're comfortable with, you know, not always being in a position of defending that your work is actually art and that it's worthy of, you know, acceptance.
Uh-huh.
So it talks about how it's not, God, I wish I could play it for you.
I know what we're...
It's sort of about how, you know, it's not about looking pretty and it's not about being packaged and it's not about, it's not sponsored by a corporation. And if that makes it less attractive and it makes it rougher and it makes it more raw, that those things are not necessarily detracting from the beauty of art, but rather adding to what art can be.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Maybe we could have a little sample. You and Neve have a piece that you performed together called Gender Game.
Uh-huh.
Could we have a bit of that, or would you do that for us?
Yeah, we'd love to do that for you. This is called Gender Game, and we actually wrote this piece about after having many experiences where we were asked if we were in the wrong bathroom, and we noticed that there were a lot of folks that we hang out with who had that similar experience. And then Neve also had the experience of having this person say, you know, ma'am and sir, sort of every other sentence to her, sort of taking the 50-50 approach to gender.
That's a good description.
Guaranteed to be right half the time, I suppose.
Right.
Oh, what a trip.
This piece is dedicated to the 50-50 approach.
Great.
You want to give me a shina? Because I look like this and I got a vagina? See, I'm familiar with this gender game. I played this war many times before in the playground of my identity. When puberty hit, like dodgeballs and freeze tag, the sissy fag, my best friend dissed me.
Common interest.
Different anatomy. See, vagina meant quieter, caretaker, peacemaker. Vagina meant keeping lips closed, keeping body posed.
Vagina was silent dolls and no action toys. Vagina was punches when I play with a boy.
So I learned to take it in the stump.
I learned to fight to make friends.
And as I learned to make that bowl, and vagina became a slippery slide for my little finger. Vagina became a quiver that lingered. Vagina became what I looked for, worked for, stood for. I mirror my vagina all over the place. I revitalized vagina's grace. I discovered vagina's taste.
I became a fine dina. I put my face in vagina after vagina.
And then I was faced with some other lip service putting me in my place. The vagina should not be liberator.
The dictator.
Of the shoes we wear.
The hair we crop.
The palms we clap.
The way we walk.
The face we use.
The threads we chew.
Well, I refuse to follow suit.
I gotta confess, my straitjacket's a dress.
You know, it used to be a crime to wear clothes that didn't scream vagina.
Oh.
I wear these shoes so I can move with my own easy spirit. I don't shave my legs because it gets cold. Besides, my legs rebel against the bloody hell of shaved and sliced. And since when is my body hair something to judge? Is furry a male privilege?
Or a patriarchal plot by Gillette?
I don't cut my nails because I've got hammering to do. I'm pounding out my path as I cruise this gender landscape, as I peruse the choice between silence and violence.
Matthew Shepard was bent, so you hang him to a fence. Brandon Tina was murdered as a liar for hiding his vagina, and I can't even sit in a restaurant without causing a stir.
What do you have, sir? What do you have, sir? What do you have, sir?
I have a vagina.
Yes, I've got a vagina, and you can still call me sir, because I can't cure this visual disease of yours, but I don't give a damn about sir
or ma'am.
So in the F or M boxes they give,
I forgive myself for not fitting in.
And blame the world for lack of clarity.
I deliberate.
Penis, I got one, you know. I write down D for dildo. I fill in D for
dildo.
I fill in F for
giant.
Vagina. And I am too big for these boxes they give, too real for this gender toyland built over soiled contradictions with Barbie bricks and Ken cornerstones built over the skulls and bones of our transgendered ancestors. Danger. She-men working above
and beyond. You. Yes, we are deconstruction workers. We're exposing unfounded bedrocks that fed us with one sex, that wed us to one gender.
We are overturning those stones. We are throwing them back.
We are making revolution.
A gender evolution.
We are invoking strategy.
We are revoking shame.
And we are calling it.
We are calling it.
Refusal to be named.
Powerful.
Thanks.
Wow.
Yeah, that was terrific.
Thanks.
Oh.
Yeah.
I wish we could be there to see you.
Yeah, I guess that's a different experience.
Oh, that was very good, though. It came across terrific.
Thanks.
Yeah, I love the deconstruction workers.
Yeah, we actually have stickers and T-shirts that that we sell that say deconstruction worker that have little pictures of a little working dude on them. So.
I need one of those. Those are great.
They're on our website. But
How long have you two guys been working together?
We've been working together for about 4 years.
Cool. How'd you meet? How'd you get started together?
Neve was working for city government doing a big fellowship scholarship and was totally disillusioned with government. And we just decided to take a plunge and live freely and dive into art. And so we just did.
It's a scary thing.
Yeah. And we had no money for a long time, but I was also working in a gay and lesbian bookstore in New York, and that was really helpful because it kept me thinking. You know, I think that jobs like that are sometimes more helpful than any other kind of job because you're just meeting all kinds of people and constantly engaged with literature and meeting lots of authors and writers who came in. So I was just very inspired for quite some time.
Yeah, nothing like being tied into the community.
Yeah.
And that wonderful cauldron of chaos and creativity that
exactly.
really bubbles and stirs. How did you start writing, Alex?
I've been writing for my entire life. And I was raised by parents who were very, very active in the political communities. My mom teaches women's studies and, my dad is a labor activist, and a labor organizer and a professor of political science. And my stepmother organizes the mental health community. And I was just always sort of engaged in that. And then I was also acting, but I was doing these stupid girl roles, you know, my entire, all up until, you know, the middle of college. And I think at some point it just clicked. I have these interests and I have these passions and, you know, society tells us that they can't work together. But let me see if they can. And I just started trying to write about politics and also make it artistic and then perform it. And it just clicked. And then I moved to New York and went to a poetry slam. And it was an open mic and I was brand new in New York and I was so nervous and I was waitressing and just after waitressing one day went to this the New Yorican Poets Cafe and was just embraced by the community and felt so powerful and alive. And it was really one of the first times that I was around such a diverse community. And I just felt like this is what I meant to do. And then I made the national team and we won nationals that year and started traveling as this little political pack around the country. And then gradually started doing, you know, collecting a body of work that I could perform on my own. And I've been doing it for about 2.5 years.
What's it like performing on your own versus working with a team?
I mean, it's a different experience. We definitely attract a much more diverse, wider audience when we're performing together because we represent a lot of perspectives and a lot of backgrounds, racially and gender and sexuality, very diverse. And so in a lot of ways, it's like a rainbow alliance, you know, it's sort of like the Jesse Jackson dream when the five of us are together. And I think that is incredibly powerful. And I can't really match that, you know, with my particular identity.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's not the same thing as my shows, which tend to be, you know, feminist communities coming together to experience ourselves and to explore issues that are really about our community. So they're both really, you know, really amazing experiences for me, but they're very different.
How would you define for our listeners out there that may not have heard the term before, slam poet? What is a slam poet?
I mean, a slam itself is poets coming together to, you know, perform their work and have the audience be engaged and to be accountable to the audience in a lot of ways. And the way it works is the audience actually gives scores on a scale of 1 to 10 to the poets. But it's actually not, it's competitive, but it's not really competitive. It's sort of a tongue-in-cheek, ironic sense of competition where, you know, it just means what mood is the audience in? Who do they like tonight? What's affecting them personally? And I think that the whole idea, it was created by a construction worker in Chicago. And the whole idea was that poetry should be about people and about people's experiences and community instead of an isolating experience of like this person behind a, you know, podium just reading their poetry and being intimidating and people feeling like they have to get dressed up for it, you know? And so it really became this community experience of like shouting back to the poet, you know, positive encouragement and, just being a very sort of based on, you know, old folk poetry, what I like to call folk poetry of, you know, and then beatniks. And it's a sort of like a more engaging experience. And from there, I think a lot of poets like myself have just taken on that concept and taken on those ideas and embraced, that sense of accountability to an audience and, you know, become performers in their own right, you know, utilizing those theories about poetry.
It's the best I know of the oral traditions, and also the audience participation is really wonderful because it breaks down that sort of elite hiding behind
yeah.
a podium, that sort of high art of I'm going to deliver it to you, and
right.
it unites an audience about a common experience, and these are the threads that kind of hold us all together, and it really touches, I think, wonderful emotional chords in all of us. Nancy
mm-hmm.
and I heard you. I think you won the Slam Poet Award at Outright in '99.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Wonderful poems, and we were very moved. It's the stuff that once it gets you up and gets your blood running and,
right.
and gets you going and doing stuff.
Yeah. I think feminism and slam poetry are so intertwined. I think they're so similar because they're battling this idea that life has to be, you know, removed and separated from itself and from its correspondence and its portions. I think that slam poetry, for example, takes down the, you know, the fourth wall that we're taught is supposed to be there with art. And I think feminism is the same thing. It's in your face and it holds people accountable to each other and it creates community. And so for me, the two work together, you know, incredibly well.
Well, I agree.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, certainly slam poetry brings voices, to in a way, it seems it almost democratizes
yeah.
poetry. It makes it more accessible for everybody.
It does, right.
It makes it, I would even be tempted to get up on stage
right.
and perform in a slam, but I certainly don't consider myself much of a poet.
Oh, you've
right.
written some great stuff, Nancy.
But, you know, it's sort of, I mean, it does because it takes it away from that sort of rarefied atmosphere of who gets to be a real poet.
Yeah.
And so forth, you know, you know, it also makes it, of course, a lot of fun.
And
right.
it also validates our lives and even some of the mishaps we have, because if we can get up and we can read about it and have the courage to do that.
Absolutely.
It's like, that's okay. And you actually find there's other people out there that are doing the same stuff. I mean, I write about
mm-hmm.
being a drag queen, essentially, and realizing finally that I had the good fortune to be born in a woman's body. And it
right.
wasn't always that easy, but,
right.
you know, to try to talk about it. And it brings people coming up talking about other things. You have another poem, and I wonder if we could hear Daughter.
Sure.
It's a very
yeah.
powerful work.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks.
I'll teach my daughter to bang on anything that makes the beat. She'll shake the room, she'll quake a room, she'll paint her cheeks warrior style and smile, beguile you, turn you inside out till your guts plead guilty. She'll be built like a truck, built to work you down as she works herself up. She'll make holes in the streets in her 10-inch spike heels and combat boots, stilts on roller wheels. She'll stroll through male pride, Amazon babes at her side. She'll relinquish white privilege, observe, be wise. She'll compromise when the fire is stoked by other women's desires, but she'll never leave the flame. All the same, she'll crave what makes her burn. She'll learn her own good name. The thick red lips, the small pink tip, no more this cryptic, this vagina will be known. She'll park in all the wrong places, make faces of police cars, wind up behind bars, bust out big before serving her time, fingernails full of this grime we call reality. She'll dig her way through. She'll pick her nose when she has to. She'll scratch her ass. She'll be a crass Medusa child, a wild, healthy fiend. She'll live in all fonts and all sizes. Curly cues, caps, italics, and bold. She'll fold airplanes of shredded cosmos and mademoiselles and pilot them to Never Say Neverland, where Peter Pan's gay and Wendy's okay with it. She'll wear a thick braid. She'll shave her head. She'll eat thick bread. She'll let her breast flop. She'll mop the floor like Cinderella. Then with rebellion prowess, she'll unionize daughters for a higher allowance. She'll be male and female and in between. So preen, then crack her mirror, crack a beer, and watch Love Connection. She'll go for days without taking a shower just to feel unchained ivory slave power. She'll want more than what she's entitled to. She'll watch through Nike commercials and she'll just undo it. Ask who's making that, who's breaking their backs, keeping her, breaking her through that glass ceiling. She'll do all of this. And she'll do none of this. And it's funny how we hide behind these daughters, hide ahead of our own histories, scared of ourselves, scared of the world, scared of someone who made us one way or another. Well, this time around, I'll be bound to my own mind womb. In my own birthing room, I'll squeeze out each crimson thick belief, then eat each pungent sweet placenta, and relieved I will tear off this country's welcome to the world certificate, tear off my father's name. I'll legitimate my own entrance into a thinking existence. I will birth myself towards persistence, but no frantic tick-tock of this biological clock. On my own time, four mothers at my sides, sisters as midwives, I'll cut my cord, head for that war. I will birth myself into this drum-beating bastard child, head first, mind first. I will mother myself into my own grown daughter, and I will call myself a home-grown woman.
Woo.
Wow. Wonderful. Oh, Alex, that's so great.
Thanks. Very inspiring.
Very inspiring to listen to you. Wonderful what you do with words, the way you bring out very intense and exciting imagery.
And possibilities. You fold time and space, Alex.
Wow. Power. God, I wish I heard about that. I run for president.
So, unfortunately, we do have to fold, but
yeah.
I understand there's a website people can visit?
They sure can. Yeah, it's ironically, we are our very own .com. So you can go to www.alixolson.com. .com, and you can check out our summer tour schedule. June 8th is actually the kickoff of our summer tour. We have, I think, about, I don't know, 70 dates throughout the summer. We're just kind of getting in our car and going across the country doing shows. Yeah, so people want to check that out.
And hopefully taking a vacation at the end of it.
Well, we're ending up, I'm performing in Michigan this summer.
Oh, cool.
So that'll be sort of one of the last dates.
Nice.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and if people want to check out the CD as well, Goldenrod is our main distributor right now. So our goal really is to get it into independent bookstores so that people don't have to buy from corporate bookstores.
Now, is that available right now?
Yep.
The CD? Okay.
Yeah, it sure is.
And that's Built Like That?
Built Like That. It can be ordered off of our website. And
we'll provide a link to that.
That'd be great.
On our website, on this page.
And if people want information about the Drag King workshops that you and Neve do, is that on the website as well?
Yeah. Neve, actually, we have a third person in Feed the Fire. Her name's Sarah Kowal.
Wait a minute. Did we say what Feed the Fire is?
Feed the Fire is our production company.
Okay.
So we book the Drag Kings out of Feed the Fire. We run the grant program. We produce a CD through the Feed the Fire label. We do a whole bunch of stuff. Constantly evolving. But so the two Drag Kings are Pat Rierich and Ray Kruder, and they travel around the country to colleges doing shows and doing workshops. So you can get information about them off of the website as well.
Oh, great. And hopefully we'll talk to them at some point, too.
That'd be great. Yeah, they're really wonderful. Good. They actually were just taped for a big documentary on Drag King culture. So,
very exciting. Great stuff, Alex.
Thank you both so much.
Oh, well, thank
you. Yeah, I hope to see people at the show in Boston. I think it's going to be really fabulous. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah.
I love Boston.
Well, I'm sure many of our listeners will be there.
Great.
Once again, it's Friday evening, June 8th at the Paradise Club on Commonwealth Ave. And I think most people know where their Paradise is, but it's up between BU and the split between Common Ave and Brighton Ave, I believe.
Great, and I think we'll probably have that information as well on the website if people want to go.
And you're also performing on June 6th, I understand?
June 6th is in New York.
Okay.
At the Bitter End.
Bitter End.
Uh-huh. And okay. then we'll be in Northampton. No, I'm sorry. We'll be in Provincetown the 9th and the 10th, performing with Pamela Means at Vixen and Chasers.
Great.
I want to check that out, too.
All right, Alex.
Yeah, thank you both so much, and congratulations on your wonderful work.
Well, thank you.
Thank you to you and Neve as well.
You know, many times over. It's very inspiring to have people like you to be energized by and to enjoy. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks.
Take care now.
All right.
Have a great tour. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, that was our interview with Alex Olson. My apologies for the technical quality of that. The sound quality was all my fault. I take the responsibility and the blame. Anyway, do we have an announcement?
Thank you, Nancy.
Do we have a special message, Hal?
Yes, we do have
Let's
a special message.
Let's roll it. We got to move quick, folks. We get to our guest.
A common complaint heard in the Boston area is that there is no place on the radio where one can hear real soul music these days. Well, complain no longer, because soul is alive and well each and every Sunday on your R&B Jukebox, a program dedicated to the preservation of the best of soul and rhythm and blues of the last 40 years. From down-home blues to spreading the gospel news, from Motown Get Down to that funky Memphis sound, from muscle shows to that sweet Philly soul, it all happens on your R&B Jukebox, hosted by Captain Al Franklin, every Sunday at 6 p.m. here on WMBR Cambridge, where soul still lives.
All right.
I just melt every time I hear his voice.
I know. What a beautiful voice. Okay, let's take it for our announcements. Karen and Hill.
Here's what is happening for the week of June 4th, 2001. Job announcement. The Trans Health and Education Development Program, JRI Health, is looking to fill a new position of program coordinator. To apply, they want your resume accompanied by a cover letter describing relevant experience and training and your interest in this particular position. And for info, call me and I'll give it to y'all, everything over the phone at 617-253-8810. But wait till I'm done with the announcements.
And on Wednesday, June the 6th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., the FTM Center at Boston Medical Center is pleased to announce their annual Pride Week open house. There'll be refreshments, socializing, community building, networking. All FTMs and their guests and friends and allies are welcome. All those interested and are questioning are welcome. For information, give them a call at 617-889-5197, or they can be reached online at FTM Center, one word, at mailcity1word.com.
And call us at 617-253-8810 if you've missed anything, but wait till the announcements are over. Friday, June 8th at 7 p.m. is the Boston Dyke March 2001, celebrating our bodies. They're meeting in front of the Boston Public Library. The route is wheelchair accessible. Rally will be ASL interpreted. The post-march rally will take place at the gazebo in the Boston Commons.
And on Saturday, June the 9th, from 9:30 a.m. to 11 a.m., Pride Brunch, sponsored by the Cambridge Lavender Alliance for LGBT folks and friends, where at Cambridge City Hall, 795 Massachusetts Avenue, wheelchair accessible, lots of good food, good people. For information, give them a call at 617-492-6393. The event is free, but donations are welcome.
June 9th, Saturday, which is like this coming Saturday, it's going too fast. At 12 noon, it's the Boston Pride Parade starting on Boylston Street through the South End to the Boston Common. And that does it for the announcements.
Oh, thank you, guys. Big, exciting Pride Week happening there, huh?
What was that?
Big Pride Week happening there, eh?
Yeah, lots of fun stuff going on.
All right. Sorry we're missing out on that. We'll be here at Pride here in Albuquerque and Gordina. I think you have an announcement or two? Did you have an announcement?
No, she already did those.
So oh, okay,
they
great.
Were included, but Nancy will be playing at Pride here in Albuquerque.
Checkers,
and Joe's
they, right?
going to be doing some playing as well.
That's right. Joe and I are going to get up there on stage with our guitars and do a couple of numbers. Speaking of numbers, our next guest, Gordon.
It's time for our next guest, who is Samuel Delaney. And Samuel Delaney is one of the best-known science fiction authors who's recently re-released Dahlgren. Has been breaking waves. It's a masterpiece that takes on cultural issues, including race, gender, sexuality, and much more. Samuel has been one of the first openly gay science fiction writers of his time, and he has also contributed scholarly criticism, fantasy books, poetic novellas, and erotica, and teaches creative writing as well. Welcome to Gender Talk, Samuel.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm afraid I can't hear you.
Oh, well.
It's a poor patch, so I can't really hear what's going on there.
Oh, dear.
Oh, and we're hearing a little tone while you're speaking. Can you hear us at all now, Samuel?
I'm sorry, I can't. I'm not getting any of you. There's just a humming on the line. I wish I could give you a hand there. can you guys perhaps straighten that out at your end?
Well, we're certainly working on it. I know there's two heads going at it in the studio right now, Samuel.
Might be a good idea to give me a call back on another line.
Okay. Our engineer is nodding her head yes. Thanks so much. We'll be calling you right back.
I'll be right back with you.
All right.
Too bad, but Samuel, we'll get him right back on the line.
Yeah, let's talk about some of this.
He's written extensively about sexuality, and one scholar even called him America's answer to Michel Foucault, who wrote History of Sexuality.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty lofty praise.
Well,
Foucault has been a guiding light for a lot of people who are investigating sexuality issues.
Well, and you know, in the 1980s, too, he also was a founder of a group known as Gay Fathers of the Upper West Side.
Cool.
So did a,
so
did a
gay
lot of work in that.
As well as writer.
And as an African-American writer, he's been compared to Octavia Butler, who does tremendous science fiction, sort of futuristic and kind of magical realism novels, which Dahlgren has been called as well as kind of a crossover.
Right. Dahlgren is his novel that's just being reissued. It was originally published in 1975. It's being reissued now with a foreword by William Gibson. And it's, in the foreword, Gibson talks about, how, he doesn't really completely understand, the novel, and he, but he lauds it very highly. Samuel, are you there now?
That's about, 60% better.
So, okay.
can we live with it?
I think we can. Let's go.
Okay,
all right. Thanks
great.
So much.
Thank you for joining us.
Okay, this is not science fiction, obviously, because there are technical glitches here.
I guess that's one of the differences between, in science fiction, the technology always works.
Yes, you know, that's a huge
excellent
difference.
Point.
That's one of the things that, because I used to read science fiction a lot as a young boy, and then when I got out into the world of engineering and real technology, I found out that stuff, as often as not, doesn't work. It was
right,
quite a...
Yes. Wonderful when it does, but when it doesn't, it's an adventure.
Yeah, to put it very kindly. Let's talk about your book, Dahlgren, since that was sort of what brought us together and what called you to our attention. It's being reissued. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Vintage Books has brought back, has decided to bring back actually a whole series of my books. They're doing five of them, and Dahlgren is the one that they're starting with.
Congratulations.
It's a book that was written it was conceived almost 30 years ago and published about 27 years ago. It's a book that, when I wrote it, I just thought I was writing about the kinds of things that I saw around me, sort of with a little bit of science fictional distortion to sort of add, I don't know, a certain spice. But some of many of the things that I saw around me indeed had to do with race and gender and a landscape that was allowing people to try to live their lives somewhat differently than they had been before. And these are some of the things that people bring up when they talk about the book today.
Sure.
So you're talking about the cultural backdrop of the hippie movement, the countercultural revolution, sexual revolution,
yes,
all going on.
Perhaps all of that, yes, gets into it one way or the other. Yeah.
Great.
Cool. I have to say I used to look to science fiction as sort of a place to propose solutions to some of the pressing social problems or to some you know, ways to move into solve a world where the problems have been solved, or
yeah, that was often a way. It is often a way to do it. Darwin's a little different in that it's not even when it was written, it was not far future science fiction. It was sort of much more like near future science fiction. So it couldn't offer so much in the line of solutions, but it could at least I think it helped some people. I think perhaps articulate at least some of the questions.
Can you give us just a little synopsis about what Dahlgren focuses on for our readers who haven't read it?
I think that the easiest way to describe what might be going on in the book is if you remember the kinds of things that went on in pretty much every major American city from the end of the 50s through the beginning of the 70s, where the various and sundry black and Hispanic neighborhoods were through a process that indeed had socioeconomic explanations, but nevertheless to most people looked like a species of malevolent black magic. Suddenly all these areas, which had been extremely crowded before, suddenly turned into sort of abandoned shells as people left them in droves.
Yes.
And they turned into sort of the phrase burned out inner city so entered the language. And it was not just a New York problem, which is where I lived and had grown up, and indeed had grown up in Harlem, one of the areas that turned into one of these strange abandoned sites. It was a problem for every major American city. Well, in the book, I postulated a city at the center of the United States where whatever had happened in these black and Hispanic ghettos, whatever strange thing happened to the entire city, so the entire city was just a sort of an abandoned shell. And various and sundry people moved into the city, living off the ruins, living off the scraps, scavenging for what they could find, and attempting to set up a new way of life in the midst of these ruins. Some people tried to set up a commune in the middle of what had been the park. Others tried to set up a more violent or sort of power oriented group, kind of like a biker gang, only nobody has any bikes. Others try to live a much more what you might call a normal life. Others try to live all out their various and sundry fantasies, and all of these kind of interact. And our main character, who is not quite sure who he is, moves from one to the other and interacts with people in all of these various groups.
Sounds fascinating. It sounds like also a fun opportunity to kind of explore these different approaches and to
Right. Yeah. He experiments. He experiments sexually. He experiments, just in a number of sort of at a number of social levels as best he can. And like everybody else, he wants to find a way that he can live, you know, at his most comfortable.
That's great. And I understand that it was made into an opera.
Well, into a young Los Angeles composer, Quentin Llorente, made it into a rock opera more than a decade ago now. But I must say that was quite exciting. I never actually saw it perform, but he sent me tapes of it. And I must say it was quite an exciting thing to find your own story suddenly transferred to a stage with people singing away for all they're worth.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
yes.
Michael Bronski, really well-known gay critic and writer himself, said one time that what you did was put into words the kind of thoughts about sex that most people keep to themselves. How do you do that, Samuel?
Well, I just put in my own thoughts about them. I think sex is a very large part of what we think about as we just move through our lives. I think somebody's actually done some sort of study and came out with the anomalous statistics that most men think about sex once every 10 seconds, and
I think
came up with a notion that most women think about sex once every 30 seconds. I have no idea what the difference.
Oh, they just shortchanged us, Samuel.
What the difference in these statistics actually mean, or whether indeed they're accurate. But I think they do remind us of the fact, one way or the other, that sex is not something that is just reserved for, you know, when you're in bed with somebody else. It's something that's a current that flows through, the all of our negotiations in one way or the other.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Did you catch a lot of heat when you first, when this book was first published, or did you get immediate acclaim for it?
Well, it was fairly controversial, at least in the science fiction field where it originally came out. And I've never been quite exactly sure why. That's probably one of the perspective problems of sitting in the middle of such a brouhaha. You don't see it from the outside, so it's a little difficult to judge exactly what the problem is. I don't think it was the sex per se, simply because there's not that much of it in the book. I think if you actually count the pages where sex is described in what is essentially an 800-page book, I'm surprised if it comes to 40 of those pages.
Was there a lot of gay sex, or was it straight?
Yes, the main character has sex with men and women, and finally sort of establishes a menage a trois with a younger man, a younger boy, and a woman.
That, you know, that's one of the things that I found very liberating about science fiction. At least the works that I was reading, for the works that appealed to me the most, were the works that sort of dispense with the conventional kind of ideas about sexuality, and instead were much more liberated and responsive to basic human feelings, and didn't make judgments about it, and so you had a broader range of actions for people, and you know, people could couple with various kinds of other people, and it didn't necessarily have to be in order to raise a family or whatever.
Right. Well, in the landscape of Dahlgren, because the economic underpinnings have been kind of removed, they're not the same kinds of economic pressures to conform. People become a lot more, fluid, I guess you'd be, you know, in their sexuality and in their working it out. And people sort of try it in ways that I saw going on around me 25 years, 27 years ago, all the time.
Me too.
But at the same time, were perhaps not quite as people weren't quite as easy about it as they are in the novel.
Yeah.
Because they do have the real life concerns, with jobs and what have you that they do. One of the things about Dahlgren is almost the entire cast of characters does not work. In fact, I think that may have been one of the reasons why people were rather upset with the book. The notion that you have an 800-page novel that's neither about people who are independently wealthy or have jobs, was a little unusual.
Well, and so their libidos have not been robbed, as Marcuse would say, and so they are able to have sex. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you think about science fiction as a genre for social commentary?
Well, I think it's like any other, not like any other genre. Novels are made out of the social, but I think all art is made out of the social, to the extent that all art is made in one way or the other out of historical elements. Even a piece of artwork that's just a totally abstract pattern, it's a totally abstract pattern that's made today rather than 100 years ago or 10 years in the future. So I think that there's a kind of a historical binding of any, of the elements in any artwork, I'm quite happy with that.
let me narrow that a little bit.
Sure.
Then let's talk about activism and progressive politics. You've done some activism yourself. There was an organization,
Gay Fathers of the
right,
Upper West Side,
that you founded, I guess, or ran, or
yeah, there were three of us who started this group of gay fathers back in the late 70s.
I always thought that, I've always kind of wanted to write science fiction.
Yeah.
One of these days, maybe I will. But it always seemed to me that it would be a place where I could put sort of the things that I wanted to say about society and living in the world and maybe propose alternatives or just make comment on them.
Sure.
That seems to me like the best possible use for it. What do you think about what's being done with science fiction today?
Well, there are some very interesting books that have come out in the last decade or so. Do you know Maureen F. McHugh's China Mountain Zhang?
No, it sounds great.
Well, that's a book that you really should look up.
Okay.
I taught it at the University of Massachusetts the last time I taught a large science fiction class. And every year, if you're teaching, and you're especially if you're a large class, you always put in one book that you think no one will really get.
Yes.
But you put it in hoping that one or two will do it. And it's a book about, in which the main character is Asian and gay. A gay male Asian, living in a futuristic United States. And this was a large class with maybe 120 kids in it. I didn't expect it to go over terribly well. It wiped all the other books off the slate. Every jock in the class loved it.
Really?
It was really astonishing. and they could, we had it. Books by Robert Heinlein, like The Moon is a Hard Mistress, which is a perennial favorite. And it's especially with the guy sorts of guys. They much preferred this book. And I asked them why. And one of the things, the answer to my astonishment was, well, this guy is concerned with sex. He's interested, even though the sex is not the same, the sexuality is not the same as theirs, nevertheless, he's concerned with it. And the result is that they found it much easier to identify with the main character of this book than they found with a relatively sexless, hero of The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah.
And I found that just amazing.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is China Mountain Zhang?
China Mountain Zhang by Maureen F. McHugh.
Maureen McHugh.
McHugh, and I would recommend it to you and all your readers. It's an extraordinary book.
That's great.
All right, and we'll try to get her on the show even.
Yeah.
Cool. Any other great recommendations for us while we're at it?
That's certainly probably at the peak.
Yeah.
Then there are many other books that I'm sure you already know.
Now
I'm a great fan of Joanna Russ's The Female Man.
Wonderful book.
Yeah, an extraordinary book. And indeed, all of Russ's other work, including We Who Are About To, The Two of Them, and The Adventures of Alex, which is a rip-roaring sort of proto-feminist adventure with a sort of swashbuckling lady barbarian.
I love it.
Cool. Wonderful. What about your... Oh, go ahead, Gertie.
I was just going to say, what are you working on right now, Samuel?
Well, I'll be honest. I don't usually talk about the books I'm working on right now.
Totally understandable.
Because I find that if I talk about it, I end up not writing it.
Wow.
However, I am working on another novel that has got about, I would say, if I'm lucky, another 6 months. If I'm not, another year before it's finished.
Let's talk about some of your other work then, because you've been quite prolific, not just in science fiction, but actually in a broad... range of areas. Can we talk about some of them?
Sure, by all means. What would you like to ask about?
How about a favorite? Do you have a favorite in any of the different genres?
Well, asking a writer what
her
favorite is sort of like asking a parent, what is his or her favorite child.
Well, that's easy.
It's what you're working on,
me.
Huh?
and the current one is always the favorite.
Yeah.
Although I did a book of sort of composed of two long essays a couple of years ago called Times Square Red, Times Square Blue. Which was about the Disney takeover of Times Square, and specifically what it meant for working class gay men in New York City.
Well, that's fascinating.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's composed of two essays, one of which is a relatively user-friendly essay, describing what the kinds of things that went on in the porn theaters, because the porn theaters in that area were also places where a great deal of sexuality actually went on, in the theater itself.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and the second essay is a more theoretical analysis of two modes of sociality, one of which I take from James Jacobs, the notion of just contact, where you meet people in public spaces and have interactions with them, and the other, and I contrast this to networking, which is what most people mean by networking, and that's where you consciously bring a bunch of people together who have like interests, like needs, like backgrounds,
sure.
And you allow them, you know, and you allow them to interact. I think what's one of the things that's happened in our society is that there's people are putting more and more of their trust and their hope in networking,
yes.
And less in just random contact in public spaces. And I think the problem with this is that paradoxically, everybody is expecting these networking groups to give them a leg up or an extra opportunity or
right.
or some knowledge that will help them get ahead. Where oddly enough, if you look at it, because in a public space where you have lots of different people, preferably from different classes, the needs themselves are so varied. You have a larger chance of coming out with something particularly useful to you.
Yeah,
whereas in a networking group, because everybody needs the same thing,
yes.
you have a much smaller chance statistically of getting, you know, the particular thing that you want.
That's
we've got about 3 minutes.
Thanks, Al.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have
Well, this is what I analyzed in this particular book.
Wouldn't you say that's analogous to diversity in the general population?
Absolutely. Yeah,
yeah, I see that.
Exactly.
Too.
Because the more different perspectives, the more likely you are to come up with a creative solution that you hadn't thought
Absolutely.
Of
previously.
And it doesn't go down. When I hear networking in an academic setting, it always seems like it's skimming the surface. It's wanting more, but it's never satisfied.
Right, exactly, yes. a friend of mine once said that contact is like complex carbohydrates.
Oh, yeah.
Networking is like simple sugar.
I love it.
Samuel, thank you so much. I'm sorry our time is so short.
Thank you.
Can we keep you in our database and bring you back on another time?
Yeah.
By all means, I would love that.
We would love to continue this conversation.
Do you have a website, Samuel, that listeners?
Well, you're at Voyant. www.voyantpub.com. You can find me, and then also at Wesleyan University Press and at Vintage Books, who is my major publisher at this point.
Okay.
Great. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Well, I'm looking forward to finishing it. I'm enraptured.
Yeah. Thank you. Good talking to you.
Thank you so
you
much.
You take care. Thanks
Bye-bye.
For your work.
Bye. Bye-bye.
All right. That does it for our program tonight. Wow, that was great, huh?
I love it.
Yeah, I knew that was going to be good. I felt completely inadequate then. I'm a little bit in awe because I was such a science fiction fan.
Yeah.
I'm like stumbling over
myself.
See,
I was a horror fan that read some sci-fi.
You did a great job. We got to run. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. Coming up in just a few minutes on WMBR in Cambridge's Dreams of a New Age, so don't go away. Our website is gendertalk.com, where we have over 200 shows for you to listen to. You can email any of us here at GenderTalk by first name, @gendertalk.com. So that's Hal, Karen, Gordine, Nancy, Joe, or Katrina @gendertalk.com. Our site host is TransgenderForum, tgforum.com. Thank you for hosting our archive. Gender Talk is a joint production of KUNM Albuquerque and WMBR Cambridge. Please join with us in thanking them for the use of their fine facilities. And here at KUNM, the generous support of their staff. That does it for our program tonight. We hope you've enjoyed our show as much as we've enjoyed bringing it to you. On behalf of In Cambridge at WMBR, Hal Fuller and Karen Larson, and in Albuquerque at KUNM, Joe Warnes, Katrina Lucas, and Paul Ingalls, and of course, Gordine McKenzie and myself, Nancy Nangeroni, thanks again for listening. And remember, no matter what the occasion, Gender Talk is always appropriate. Good night, everybody.